Okay, tonight we want to begin a study of the book of 1 Corinthians. We want to, as we've done with other books in the past, introduce the book. We've got a handout, an outline that we want to go through. Out of all the New Testament books, 1 Corinthians to me is one of not only the more practical books, but it's one of the more amazing books. I mean, you have a congregation that was established by the Apostle Paul, so they had some of the best teachers. Paul was not the only one who was at Corinth, but he certainly would have been the cream of the crop as we think about gospel preachers in the first century. He goes to this congregation, he invests his heart, his soul, he puts a lot of effort into this congregation, and yet you find that it is not a perfect church. There are people today sometimes who are looking for that perfect congregation, and you can go to some places and I mean, things are truly a mess, maybe not quite as bad as Corinth. But they have a lot of problems. Sometimes people are frustrated by the local congregation because it's not so much the big stuff, but just like, I guess, a marriage. Little stuff can add up after a while, and the little stuff seems like it's big stuff, but in the grand scheme of things, it's really not all that big. But if you are ever in a congregation or you feel discouraged, you're looking around and thinking, boy, we have this problem, we've got that problem, and there's this, and there's that. And that can happen to anybody, from the Bible class teacher to the person who perhaps does not attend very often, to the preacher, the elders, the deacons, whoever that might be, the wives. The book of 1 Corinthians is a good book to go back and look at, because here were people who were sticking with it in spite of some really serious issues. And that's where we begin as far as the introductory material. The church at Corinth was beset. It had a bunch of, not problems, but it had a bunch of serious problems. And we'll try to identify those. You see those really scattered throughout the book. We read about a divided church. Where do we see, or what comes to mind today when people say, our church is divided? Where do we see that? What causes division in a local congregation today?
Run the church, the rules.
All right. I had an elder about a day and a half call me and say, look, you know, we've got some issues. I wanted to call and just see what your thinking is as far as going around and, you know, talking to members and trying to figure out some of the issues that we have. And he said, this is the proposal that we had. And I said, well, if you're asking me to weigh in on that, I don't think that's a good idea. I think that You do need to try to figure out the issues. I'm not sure that the way that you have suggested is the best way to go. And here is an alternative that I've seen used in some places, and he seems satisfied with that. But that is one of the issues that they have in that local congregation right now. It is the problem of division. You have some people who are of this mind, you have some people who are of this mind, and then you have some people, apparently they really don't know which side to be on. And they're trying to get a handle on that. So division is not an old problem that has ceased. You have sexual sin. The Corinthians, they had some issues with incest. You have lawsuits among Christians. I don't know that I've ever been in a congregation where there was an actual lawsuit of one Christian against another. Anybody ever seen that in the church? One Christian suing another Christian? Well, I guess that's positive. But that has happened. And that can happen for different reasons. Sometimes it might be a business arrangement. Sometimes maybe it's a congregational matter. That's a very unfortunate situation. Marriage problems. The Corinthian letter talks about marriage issues. As we look at the church today, we find that there are marriage problems. We find that there are people who sometimes separate. We find that sometimes we deal with people who have gone through a divorce. They are going through a divorce. Maybe they have gone through multiple divorces. Maybe they're thinking about a divorce. So all of that is in the Corinthian letter. We've got perversions of the Lord's Supper. And it's not just perversions, but you have concentration issues. When the Corinthians were coming together, they were not distinguishing the Lord's Supper from the common meal. And would you say that today we have distractions when it comes to worship? We do. And we have as many distractions as any other people in history. I mean, from thinking about my belly's hungry, where am I going to have lunch? You know, the mind, you know, preacher's been preaching for a long time. I wonder when he's going to quit. This Bible class is the longest one ever. You know, I wonder when the clock's finally going to say we can go home. There are a lot of distractions in life. We have the announcement sometimes, turn off the cell phones. I think we do reasonably well. As a congregation, a lot of places do that. Sometimes you still have people forget, but there are a lot of distractions. The Corinthians had that. And then you have the Corinthians abusing some things. They abuse spiritual gifts. Paul has to take, really, 1 Corinthians 12, 13, 14, a pretty good chunk of the letter to deal with some abuses. And that still happens today. God gives his people a number of different items, a number of different blessings. But would you say that some of those blessings are abused sometimes by people?
Yeah.
They are. And maybe people don't always see it as an abuse. So there's a ton of stuff going on in this letter. As you look at 1B, yet it is, interestingly enough, and this is one of the things that to me is as amazing as anything else. You've got all these issues that we just went through, some that we didn't go through, and yet as Paul addresses them, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 2, he says, who am I talking to? I'm talking to the church of the devil or somebody else? I'm talking to the church of God. Well, what's that tell you? I mean, if this church is just riddled, it's rife with issues, and yet as Paul writes to these people, he says, you are the church of God. What does that tell us, or what does that not tell us?
They need to wake up.
Well, I think that's definitely true. They do need to make some changes. What else, though?
It still means that they belong to God.
Yeah, I mean, God has not cast them off. Now, if they didn't get their act together, then okay, it's going to be a different story. And that's the reason for the letter. Paul says, I'm writing this information, I'm giving you all these corrective actions, so to speak, just like perhaps an employee in a business. You're giving the employee, look, you're marginal here, you're failing here, you know, we're poor in attendance and all these other issues, and you have to take care of these issues, otherwise you're going to be out the door. Well, that's kind of what is taking place at the Corinthian congregation. And even in 2 Corinthians, as the opening verse begins, Paul addresses the church of God. Paul, he was the evangelist. He had helped found the congregation at Corinth. And just like, almost like a parent. In fact, Paul does use that imagery as we look at his writings, especially the Corinthian letter. He said, I was, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, I was a father. I begat you in the gospel. If you think about parents and the earthly kids, you have a child, or maybe you have several children, and that child, or at least one of those children, goes by the wayside, begins to do some really bad things, becomes perhaps involved with criminal activity, starts to run in the later years with some people who are not good influences, and they, you know, end up on Skid Row, or they have some other experiences where that's the last thing that you wanted for your child. As a parent, how do you feel, and what do?
Well, you can feel failure, you can feel mad.
Well, okay, those two things are likely possibilities. Anything else?
You mourn for them if they won't change.
Yeah, but ultimately you want them to come back to the right way, right? I mean, you can have the grief and you can have the mourning and you can be sorrowful, and all those things are certainly right, good and proper. They're natural, but you want them to come back. You want them to head back into the right way. And that's what Paul wants. He's trying to do his best. He's writing this letter. It's a very difficult letter. Has to write also 2 Corinthians. And I'm sure he spent hours and hours and hours in prayer, you know, begging God that these Christians would finally get their act together. We have two epistles which survive from his correspondence. When we look at the New Testament, sometimes people will ask about books that are not included in the New Testament. Could we potentially have inspired books that were written which are not part of our New Testament? Yes. Is that a problem if books were written but we don't have them?
We have everything.
All right. I mean, it's like saying you tell your spouse when you get married, I've told you everything about me. Think anybody's ever said that? Two young people in married, going to get married? You know everything about me. You don't think anybody's ever said that?
Sure.
I imagine they have. But what do they mean and what do they don't mean?
I told you everything.
Everything you need to know. It's not when I was three, I stubbed my toe and mom kissed it. Okay? Now that might be true. But chances are that's not going to really be a deal breaker as far as getting married to somebody. But you're trying to say, you have what you need, this is the important information, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about God and His Word being complete. We do not expect that every single letter has survived. One of the things that we read about in the Corinthian letter would be great doctrines. There are some people who object, and I guess it's technically true, but the Bible does talk about the doctrine. Some people, if you listen to them as far as preachers, they have said there are not Bible doctrines. There's only one doctrine. The word doctrines, plural, would describe false teaching. So, again, that's kind of a small point, but I don't fuss one way or the other with that. But we do have a number of great truths presented. We've got information about Jesus, information about the resurrection, information about the future state. There's just a ton of stuff in this book, and it really is a great book. We have also, as we look at 3B, inspired counsel about facing perennial, continual problems in the church. Again, it's not a complete manual. He doesn't say there are 10 steps to fix this issue, but you do see ways and pieces of advice that are still helpful today. And some of that would be, for example, involving immoral conduct. When you think about immoral conduct, we basically have two choices with it, don't we? If you're faced with someone who is involved with immoral conduct, you can do one of two things, can't you? Really? You can either or you approve it in some way. You could join in, or you could say, well, you know, everybody's kind of doing their own thing, but one way or another, you approve it, or you don't. You condemn it in some form. Now, maybe that's verbal, maybe that's mental, but you usually go one way or the other. When we look at the book of Acts, we've been talking about Paul's missionary journey, seeing how he finally gets over to Rome. We believe that the 1 Corinthians letter, the 2 Corinthians letter, were both written on Paul's first missionary journey. All right, down to that point. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little further?
It says third missionary journey.
Did I? I thought I said third. Did I say?
You said first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to say third, but thank you for the catch. All right, anybody else before we go down to the body of the letter? Okay, looking at that as far as some background information, Corinth, as you look at the city, there's some places in life. You can look at a city, especially a larger city, and if you want to move to that city, perhaps a particular section of the city, you might say that part of the city is thriving, that part of the city is alive, that's the part of the city that we want to live in. We don't want to live down here in this part of the city for what reason?
Crime.
Well, crime could be a big reason. What else?
Church.
Well, okay, it could be our religious needs. Our obligations are not going to be fulfilled well if we're down here. What else, though? Anybody ever seen a city which was in a certain area pretty much dead? I mean, it had just reached the point. The mall is gone. Gas stations are gone. Walmart's pulled out. There's nothing much left. And you're thinking, there was a report today which talked about, I believe it was Seattle. It was out west. I'm pretty sure it was Seattle, Washington. And it talked about how this neighborhood, which had once been really nice, I mean, when people opened their front door practically, there was just a slew of homeless people out there. Now, you imagine living in a place where you've got homeless people pretty much camped on your front lawn, and maybe they're out there in your backyard. That's probably not going to be too attractive to people for very long. So people in that area, in that neighborhood, which used to be apparently a very nice place to live, they decided, you know, it's gone downhill to the point where we want to see if we can get rid of it. But if you think about Corinth, this is like a bustling city. This is a place of great commerce. This is a place where people want to go. And if not to at least live there, this is a place where we want to trade. So when you start thinking about places where you have a lot of commercial activity, that will help you get a better understanding of Corinth. It was the province of Achaia, population-wise, about 500,000 people. Now, would you say that even by our standards, if you have a city that has 500,000 people, it's a decent-sized city? I mean, yeah, we would expect that's going to be a lot of roads and a lot of people and a lot of houses and a lot of business. But you can imagine in the first century, 500,000 people. I mean, this was a big, bustling place. And if you are going to be like Paul, and we've talked before, Romans 15, I believe it's verse 20, where Paul said he wanted to evangelize where the church had not been established. If you are thinking about the life of Paul, he wants to go out and spread the gospel as fully as he can. Does he want to go out and live in a community of 5,000 people? The Apostle Paul, is that where he wants to be? Well, I mean, if he wants to reach people, I mean, the 5,000 souls in that community are important. I remember a gospel preacher, and I thought about this a lot over the years. He, as he looked back at his life, essentially said, I have never, or at least never tried to live in a place which was not a major city. It was pretty much the people in those smaller communities that are not worth my time. Now, he didn't mean it quite like that, but he meant, I've only got so much time, so I want to use my resources in places where there are a large number of people. And I understand that. But at the same time, you've got people scattered in different places throughout the U.S. A lot of people are not in a major city. So some people feel like they're well-geared for that. Some other people might want to work with some smaller congregations. Some prefer a more country setting. Some prefer a more city-like setting. So there's really a spot for everybody. But Paul seemed very comfortable in this kind of environment. Anything that you want to add or ask to that information? Okay. All right. So we've got, as far as you can find Corinth on a map, you can see as far as the commerce, the communication, the traffic. I mean, this is the place where a lot of people stop. There's the old story about Sam Walton when he was getting ready to build a new Walmart. He got an airplane, flew around for a little while, over possible locations, watched the traffic, and said, I want my store right there. So I don't know that Paul would have thought necessarily in those terms, but he's looking for a place where there is a lot of traffic, a lot of people coming. And if you have sea traffic, I don't know, Ray, maybe you can help a little bit here as far as your Navy experience, as far as ports, kind of what you saw there as far as, you know, people coming in and perhaps the locals trying to create a business with all the sailors that came into port thinking these guys are going to be a steady source of income.
Most of your big cities were, large cities were pulled into, that was a big income for them, especially the U.S. sailors. But sometimes you'd pull in there, there'd be an aircraft carrier or something from England would be in there. Yes, lots and lots of military uniforms would be involved.
If you had to make a guess on a carrier, how many guys would go in for leave at once or during the time the ship was there? Okay, so that's a lot of people. I mean, you figure a couple thousand people coming in, even if only 25% of them are spending money. You have that on a fairly regular basis, and you have some business, you know, you can, you know, offer pineapple juice or something, you know, that people will perhaps try. Hey, you know, a little different than what we get from back home. It can be a thriving business. Stan?
But isn't the book or books of 1st and 2nd Corinthians witness to the problems that you have when you go to a big city where there's a little bit of everything from a little bit of everybody from a little bit of everywhere?
Yeah, and that is the problem, and that is what I think you see with sea. Prosperity and a highly transient population created a pleasure-mad and immoral atmosphere. So when you think about people who've been on a ship, especially in that day and time, it's not like on a cruise ship. You've been on this ship, and it has been unpleasant, perhaps for weeks, months, and again, sailors, I would suspect that there is a lot of that as well. There's a lot of pent-up desire, so you end up in a city, you know, where can we go to drink? You know, where can we go and womanize? Where can we go and gamble? And I mean, it's, hey, the place is wide open, and that's the reason sometimes where, you know, as well as any other vet, they've got the MPs there oftentimes because it just gets a little too wild sometimes, and they got to take them and, you know, drag them off and, you know, break up fights. But you're right. Money can breed all kinds of problems as far as crime and evil. And, you know, we're going to give you your pay. You can go into town. So Corinth had a lot of sinners, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. But, I mean, it was the place to go, I guess, Las Vegas. You know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, right? And people say, we're going to go out there and do this and that and do all kinds of things that we wouldn't necessarily do at home. And Corinth was that same kind of option. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 18 for just a second. There's a verse that kind of sprung to mind. Let's see if I'm right. Acts chapter 18, maybe going down through about verse, yeah. Acts 18:8. So we've got Paul. He goes to the city. And Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his house, and many of the Corinthians, hearing the word, believed and were baptized. That should have been very, very encouraging to Paul. The church is started. And the Lord said unto Paul, in the night by a vision, be not afraid. Now that would seem to be kind of odd, especially for Paul. If you've gotten a good foothold in this city, which is filled with wickedness, you've got some good solid converts, Paul is still concerned. So God says, or I think the Greek text there is, stop being afraid, but he said, speak and hold not thy peace. Why? I am with thee, and no man is going to set on thee to harm thee. Thus, when you start looking at that passage, Stan, I think that brings to mind exactly the point. I mean, he kind of looks around and says, you know, all right, we baptized 10 or 12, that's really great. But, I mean, the opposition, the sin, the wickedness out there, I mean, it's just like throwing a piece of sand into the ocean. You know, it just looks like there is perhaps, in his mind, not much that the church can do. But God said there are a lot of people in this city who are willing to hear the gospel. So you go out there, you get to work, and you have faith. Anybody else? Okay, let's go down a little further and see what else we have as far as there are different forms of the word, but under C1, this was such a popular place as far as sin to Corinthicize. Would be one form of the word that you see there. And that would be to go out and engage in all the things that Corinth offered. It would be like, you know, going to supersized buffet, and you think there's just so much to choose from, even if I just wanted to taste everything on the buffet, I mean, there's just too much food there. And Corinth, there was just a ton of sin there. They had the worship of Aphrodite. There was a huge following of that goddess at Corinth. You have the priestess, and they used sex for worship. That was not an concept that was limited to the Old Testament. Certainly the Hebrews had gotten involved with that, but I mean, that was one of the things. So they've got this big fancy temple, and you want to come in and let's go to church. We got a prostitute for you. And for some sailors who had been out there at sea for a while, that probably was a very, very tempting offer. In fact, we've got it down here a little bit, I think a little bit more, that they had actually talked about to sandalize, where they'd actually had steps. You know, it would be just like, you know, giving you signs, only they would be, we would expect feminine steps to say that this is the way to, you know, find the women. This is the way to come to the temple and worship. So, I mean, if you remember Mark Reynolds, when he was here before, he had shown some slides as far as the idols from India. And, I mean, it was like a well-oiled machine, like somebody coming to the fair and just trying to pump people through, you know, one right after the other, or going down to some places like Gatlinburg, where they've got their items that people can go through and see, and they just keep shuffling you through, and the money box is continually filled. So the Corinthians were not stupid. They knew how to work a crowd, to work the sea traffic and so forth, and they were very, very good at it. Stan?
Well, it's been my experience. I've been around a little bit anyway, that cities do have what we call, well, I won't call them slums, but they're areas where immorality is high.
Yeah.
And almost any of the big cities are that way. And you mentioned Las Vegas. Las Vegas is instantly brings bad things to mind. But yet, there are people that live in Las Vegas that are good people. There are good communities. There are good places and whatever. We just hit on it in the book of Acts. God says, don't be afraid because I have many people here. Well, you got to stop and think, who are those many people? They're probably not this rough group that we're talking about. So I wonder if this group of people were not the permanent people at once, but they might have been on the periphery, or they might have been in their own section of town where it was not bad to go. So they provided a group of people that Paul could work with. And yes, there was the influence of a lot of different religions from some people that were pretty wild people, but yet there were still people there that he could rely on. Also, it makes you wonder if maybe in Corinth, and I don't know this at all, somebody else will have to provide this information, but there was probably a Jewish community
mm-hmm.
that were not of a base sort, that were people that Paul could work with and feed the church.
Yeah, that always had to be encouraging to him to, you know, not be chased by the Jews, number one. And then number two, to be able to go into a synagogue and there would be people there who would, number one, listen, number two, become Christians, and number three, become committed. And I think you could be exactly right there as far as you have a group of reasonably moral people who perhaps were just on the peripheral edge. And then it's kind of like, well, okay, now how are we going to reach into, I mean, it would be like going to a large city today. And you have a congregation of 100 people, and they say, all right, we have a base here from which to work. Let's go out and start working with the homeless. Let's go down to the place where people are just on drugs. And, I mean, that would definitely be a big step of faith, and that would be challenging for a group of 100 people because you're, you know, you're entering into a completely different world. And for a lot of people, Paul included, that would be a little unsettling, I think. That it? Okay, let's go down and see what else we have. Paul, going down to point, this is going to be under the body of the lesson, E. Paul established his church on a second missionary journey or tour. Early, probably 50 AD, he works there for about 18 months. And again, going back to that Acts chapter 18 reference, leaves Corinth in late 51, early 52, and then moves over to Ephesus, and again, had a great work at Ephesus. We've talked about that. He starts the school there, and that's also a wonderful, wonderful work. He probably wrote the First Corinthian letter in the spring of his time at Ephesus, about AD 55, 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 8. As we start looking at the letter, we begin to find the basic message. He's at Ephesus. And if he's involved with the school and everything, you think, all right, things are going well. Hopefully Corinth is going to continue to well. We would expect that he continued to pray about it, but he learns of some issues. So because of those problems, he writes a letter that apparently we no longer have, 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9. And as we said before, those letters, we don't know how many of them there could be, but we don't need them. We have the information that God wants us to have. Then as things continue to go, just like in today's world, things can get better or things can degrade, things can deteriorate, and that's what happened. So Paul gets a report. Anybody remember from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 and 11? He says, I received a report from who? The household of Chloe. We don't know very much about that individual, but apparently that individual was a faithful Christian and indicates to Paul, hey, we're raising the red flag here. We're indicating that we have some issues, and we think that you should know about those things. So the church wrote Paul a letter, and we know that from 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Paul says, concerning the things whereof you wrote. Well, guess what? When you find that statement, that tells you. Now, who wrote to Paul? We don't know. How many wrote to Paul? Was it a single letter? Were there multiple people who wrote to Paul? Was there one letter that was formed by several people and many signed it? We simply don't know. But he's over here. It's kind of like you're working on a problem and somebody says, you really have to take this phone call. All right. Well, we're on fire over here. Not literally, but we have a lot of issues that need to be addressed. So he was someone. He's being chased all over. There are congregational issues. He really had some times where he must have pulled out his hair, so to speak. You have, from 1 Corinthians 7, 1 Corinthians 16, verses 17 and 18, a lot of troubling questions. So Paul, as he's trying to thread the needle to deal with all these things, it's just like anything else. If you have three kids, this one, all right, sorry you got hurt. This one, got to send you to the corner. And then this one, well, we'll help you with your math problem in just a minute. You're trying to juggle three different issues at the same time. And that's tough if you're dealing with kids. But imagine trying to do that with adults. So there are times where Paul has to challenge the Corinthians. There are times where Paul has to rebuke the Corinthians. And there are times where Paul has to exhort the Corinthians. He's trying to charge down the road in three different directions, practically. And it really is a challenging book, and it's an amazing letter. Stan?
Well, I kind of wonder here. He says that he received this letter from House of Play, and he says there are contentions among you. Now, I don't know whether there was a different word, and this is not translated entirely correct, but contention to me means infighting, arguing a book. I believe this, and this person believes that, et cetera, et cetera. So he doesn't indicate here that there's a lot of outside influence.
No, I don't really see too much. When we get to 1 Corinthians 7, he talks about not wanting or, avoiding marriage for the present distress. So there apparently, he doesn't prohibit it. He just says, I'm giving you my judgment on this because of kind of what we can see. So it does look like there's some clouds, some really dark clouds, not too far in the distant future. But for the most part, in this letter, it looks like the problems are really internal versus external. And part of that could be a lot of the people who were converted. When you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, these people may not have been the worst of the worst, but Paul says you were a thief, you were a drunkard, you were a violer, you were involved with sexual sin, you're involved with extortion. So these people may not have, gotten all the way to the bottom of the slime pit of sin, but they had definitely gotten at least one foot pretty far in the pit. Okay, as we go back and we start looking here, he tries to lead them to the right kind of life. He says, you've been changed, and you need to stick with that right road. Under D, he says, thus we may say the theme of the epistle is the duty of God's people to live a righteous life. And that's really what we're talking about throughout the New Testament, but especially in the Corinthian letter. Straighten up, live correctly, you've been saved, you've been washed, you've been sanctified, you've been justified, as we see from 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Even in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 2, he says, you are a sanctified people, therefore you need to be a saintly people. You think people need that message today?
Yes.
Yeah, but they don't get it. I mentioned to Ron, I put out some YouTube videos, and if you don't see those, you should check out this one, or I'll send you the link. There was this denominational pastor, this made the news a couple of days ago, and it takes just about 50 seconds to watch. He gets on his congregation because they did not get him a watch that he wanted. And he makes the point, if you have not seen this, I mean, it is unbelievable. He says, you've got money for McDonald's, you've got money for Red Lobster, you've got money for these clothes and everything else, and yet you did not get me my watch. I'm going to kick the door open and really rebuke you people. Now, I mean, it is just almost beyond words to see that, and I think he has now come out and apologized. But I'm thinking, if that's the teaching that some people are getting in religious groups, where are they going to be in their, well, I don't even think they can have a spiritual life, but where are they going to be? I mean, are you going to have godly people from that? Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it comes down to. Some of the stuff that you find out there as far as preaching and teaching, I mean, you just have to smack yourself upside the head sometimes and wonder. Maybe he just kind of got a little too rambunctious and didn't think things through, but I thought, wow, wow, wow. All right. If such an image, this is looking at D2, if such an image could be fixed in their minds, they could begin to live differently. They would live under Christ's authority, his leadership. And you begin to see that really throughout the book, starting with 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 31. Paul is saying, look, you've been bought with a price. Glorify God. Therefore, what? With your body. Live differently than the Corinthians. Live differently than your culture. Know that you have not been bought with a price. We have, as we look at the letter, we've got some major themes. 1 Corinthians 1, 2, 3, and 4, you have a lot of emphasis on unity. If you look at a lot of the problems in the world, they are based on a lack of unity. If you don't have united people in a marriage, what's going to happen? You're not going to make it very long. If you don't have unity in a country, what's going to happen? Well, just look around, see what we've got. If you don't have unity in the workplace, what's going to be like? Everybody's out for themselves. It's going to be a miserable environment. And if you don't have unity in a local congregation, what's going to happen? It's not going to prosper. You're probably going to have all kinds of issues. You're going to, I think one of the saddest things I've ever heard someone say in the church is, this church is his church. And they weren't talking about Christ. This church is her church. And they weren't talking about Christ. But it was because someone, you know, donated something, whether it was time, whether it was land, whether it was money for the building, whatever it was, or they were one of the founding members, so to speak. This is their church. That's not good for unity. All right. Under A1, the new life in Christ is meant to be lived in unity and peace among brethren. Wasn't that what Jesus prayed for in John chapter 17? That they all may be, how many? One, even as you and I are one. Well, that's not complicated stuff. And Psalm 133, God's people need to dwell in unity. That is a blessed state. There is no more serious problem dealt with in the Corinthian correspondence than the first one mentioned, division among brethren. So Paul hits that first. Now, we'll make this point when we get into the 1 Corinthian letter as far as the first chapter, but the division had not gotten to the point where it was irreparable. Sometimes if you think about clothing, there can be a rip. And someone who is knowledgeable about clothing says what? That
can't be repaired.
That can't be repaired. I mean, the rip is too great or whatever the problem is. There's just no way to restore that. There's really not even a good way to patch that. That was not the case at Corinth. So things were bad. Things were really serious. Paul leaves no doubt about that. But as he describes the division, he makes it clear that it had not gotten to that point. But if that wasn't fixed, then all the other issues. I mean, if you are divided, then you can understand the problems with the Lord's Supper, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. You can understand the problems as far as the lawsuits, 1 Corinthians chapter 6. I mean, it all just kind of hinges on that. In the first four chapters, Paul makes two strong points against division. Number one, baptism unites you to whom? Christ. If you are of the mind that the preacher is the one that your allegiance is to, then guess what?
Wrong.
You are going to, well, you're not only wrong, you're going to have some serious problems in the congregation. Or what happens if you say, we've got five elders, and he is my elder? You've got problems in that congregation. It is, we are all in this together. So whether it is preacher A, B, or C, elder A, B, C, D, or E, we are bound to Christ. He is the leader. He is the head. It all goes back to him. Under three, I'm sorry, Ray?
Sometimes when you have a large congregation, you have many elders, they do divide that up.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that John over here is his elder, that somebody else can't talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a practical matter. It's a matter of expediency as far as trying to ensure that you're doing the best as far as elders. But people, elders and non-elders, can sometimes get some real squirrely ideas. And when they take root, it's a problem. All right, under 3B, faithful teachers of the word do not promote personal loyalties. You do find that sometimes with people. People will sometimes say, well, you know, I've got some people with me and we want to do this or we're going to do this. Well, you may think that, you may believe that, and you might even be able to pull that off. But that's not the way of God. God's people seek peace with one another. We've seen that extensively in the book of Romans. As we look back in Romans chapter 14, Paul talked about the strong, he talked about the weak, and he said, do not, when it comes to your meat, your food, or when it comes to the day, do not do what to that weak Christian? Do not
tempt.
Well, you could say that, but there's another word. Do not, remember the word destroy? Do not destroy that weaker brethren because Christ died for him. And if you go out and you destroy, if you steamroll that guy or that woman or that group, you might win as far as the argument, but guess what?
You've lost.
You've lost, and you've lost big time. So the Corinthians, they need to hear some of the same things that we've seen in Romans. Each one is obligated to give supreme loyalty to Christ. Selfish ambition is wrong. Paul talked about in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 24 through 26, the Lord's servant. He said, you can't quarrel. That's contrary to the way of Christ. Be willing to forgive. Show the forgiveness of Christ. Several passages deal with that, one of which is Ephesians 4 and verse 32. Christ is not divided. That is a lesson that a lot of people do not understand or apply. Flipping the page, we've got, as we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, some questions about marriage. And today, I mean, the world is so messed up that they've kind of moved beyond these, but these are still things that need to be taught. The Bible talks about the sanctity of marriage. That is a novel concept for some people. And for the Corinthians, that surely was also something that was strange. The idea that one man would be married to one woman for life, again, that was probably, well, where did you get that wild idea? But you have sort of a suggested outline here. Paul talks about marriage. He talks about celibacy. He recognizes that not everyone may want to get married for one reason or another. Sometimes you have single people looked at in a negative way. Hopefully that doesn't happen in the church. But I do know that single people have sometimes been approached with questions like, well, what's wrong with you? Or you have perhaps young widows. A widow loses her husband. And people will come up and say, well, when are you going to get married? Well, it's none of your business. You know, maybe I never want to get married again. Maybe I do. Maybe I'm waiting for the right guy. But people can really ask some dumb questions. All right, you have information about divorce. The Bible does have some things to say about divorce. You have information about people who are Christians married to fellow Christians. You have relationships where a Christian may be married to a non-Christian. That's also in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And you also have Paul saying, look, we have people who have different states in life. You might be someone who has become a Christian and you're a slave. You're not a free person. Well, the question then becomes, and today you could reverse that a little bit, and you could say, all right, you are a person who has been confined perhaps for life. You are in the penal system and the judge has sentenced you to life without parole. Well, the question then becomes, if I become a Christian, wouldn't you wonder as far as what you should do or what you should think as far as your status as a Christian? Should I seek to be released? Should Christianity be my get-out-of-prison-free card? I mean, if you don't know much about the Bible, you might be asking that question. But here Paul says, if you're a slave, then you do what? You stay a slave. You know, becoming a Christian is not going to change that state. And the same thing would be true for a prisoner. All right. As you look at some information under verses 39 and 40, you have some information about widows. The Bible has some things to say about widows. Paul has some things to say about remarriage and widows. You also have some information, as we look at point number 3, some information about divorce. You know, Jesus talked about that as far as the person who has the right to put away their spouse and marry another. Matthew 19 and verse 9, he gave fornication as the reason for that. 3b, no other case for a marriage following a divorce is discussed in 1 Corinthians 7, much less allowed. You have some people who have gone to 1 Corinthians 11 and used that to teach some things which conflict with Matthew chapter 19, and we'll talk about those when we get there. So we do need to teach about divorce. People do need to know what the Bible says, but we also want to make sure that we're not always negative on that. We have a lot of young people who get married, and they need to know what God says about that, hopefully before they get married, and certainly in those younger years to be reminded to stick with it, because divorce can come with some very unpleasant consequences all around, not just with God, but as far as secular consequences as well. Then when you get over to 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, you have some information about spiritual gifts. In today's world, that's important information. There are a lot of people who do not know what the Bible says about spiritual gifts. If somebody says, I can speak with tongues, they believe them. If somebody says, I have the power to heal disease, people oftentimes will believe them. Somebody says, I have the power to believe the dead, or to make the dead return to life, a lot of people don't know if that is a correct biblical statement or not. But in 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, we have information about the nature of the spiritual gifts that were available in the first century, the purpose for those gifts, and even the duration, how long they were supposed to last. When you look at the duration, and they were limited to the first century, as we'll see, he suggests perhaps one reason their presence was temporary lies in the fact that their possessors too frequently became proud and arrogant over their abilities. I think that's a good suggestion. You find people, if they have a skill or something, they might brag about it, they might boast about it, and it just takes them out to the stratosphere, so to speak, and they just get full of themselves. So perhaps that was one of the things that the Corinthians needed to hear. The problem of large egos and offended pride remains even in their absence. So without the gifts, we still see those problems. With the gifts, and you see that in the Corinthian letter, people felt puffed up. Each person tends to feel his way is the best way. You think that's true? When it comes to serving God, you have that same kind of thing. I think we should do this. I think we should do this. I think we should do this. Now, that might be a ladies' day. That might be a gospel meeting. That might be appointing elders. But whatever comes up, you might have 10 different ways to do it. And any of those 10 ways necessarily bad? No. All 10 ways possibly just about equal as far as a good outcome?
Sure.
Sure. But people, once they put their ego into it, then what happens? It has got to be my way. Well, no, it doesn't. And maybe your way isn't the best. So every Christian has to watch that. He says under 3a, we have seen where this leads to fragmenting congregations and dividing the brotherhood. And that's true. But there is a more excellent way, 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 31, and that is love. Love allows people the freedom to serve in their special spheres of interest and in ways that may be different from the brethren. 1 Corinthians 13 makes that point clear. Mutual submission to Christ is always important. That will always help promote unity. So long as one is walking in the path of truth, love prohibits forcing him to conform to our personal tastes, opinions, or preferences. And that, again, is a huge problem in a lot of places. People have a certain preference. They have certain desires. Maybe they want to continue with something that's been a practice for a long period of time. And just like a child, if I don't get my way, then what's going to happen? I'm unhappy, so you're going to be unhappy, and we're all going to be unhappy. Well, you probably can accomplish that, but again, that is not the will of God. We have a duty to evangelize, but cannot prescribe a single methodology. We must care for widows and orphans, but again, we've got some leeway as far as how to do that. Reader's Guide to 1 Corinthians, again, we've kind of touched on that. You can kind of read through that again. Concluding matters, you'll see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 5 through 24, and then Paul's going to talk about his travel plans, exhortations, and give readings. There is a lot of similarity when you look at the Corinthian congregation and our general decline in Western culture today. So when we look at this letter, we find the appeals, we find the rebukes, we find the points of emphasis, very, very practical for us.